So you need these. I mean, these things go long. They're end to end. They're like 100 feet long. So it's pretty massive. Let me drop this thing. So the weight of this thing, it weighs like over 6,000 pounds. And that's without the fuel. The fuel, you add another like 30% to that. You know, when I think of 6,000 pounds, I think of about the weight of three little cars, you know, three little Toyotas or something. And here these things are flying out well past Mars. So that's why they need the big solar panels. Just could imagine. I mean, you've got another spacecraft going to Jupiter with big solar panels like this too, called Juno. And if you're out there, you know, without the nuclear generators, they need gigantic solar panels due to the inverse square law. If you're in close to Earth, no problem. You get out to Mars beyond, they're going to have to be, you know, maybe equivalent of four times bigger than what you would need at Earth to get the same amount of power. So, that's it. I thought I'd just mention Rosetta. Let me drop it. So you were asking about the guy that ran the Spirit and Opportunity missions. This guy, Steve Squires, you know, what's he doing? And he really didn't get too involved with the with Curiosity. They had another guy that was in charge, really in charge of engineering of the original rovers, you know, Spirit and Opportunity. He moved on to take over Mars Science Laboratory, now called Curiosity. But Steve Squires wound up involved with the NEMO project. Know anything about the NEMO project? It's by NASA. It's an acronym, of course. NASA Extreme Environment Mission Operation. They go down to Florida, down near Key West, and they go about 60 feet underwater, drop it. And they stay down there for days at a time, and they fully do like, 2 weeks, you know. They'll do these 2 week missions. And he's going to be part of this next mission. In fact, he was part of the last mission. And they'll go down with about five people and do research very similar to what you would be doing in a spacecraft. And in this case, they're going to be simulating going to an asteroid, you know, astronauts going to an asteroid. So this guy, Steve Squires, is really involved. I mean, not only did the last mission, he's doing this mission as well. And he's like one of their aquanauts now. And they'll be practicing using a delayed time for communication with mission control. And you know, they'll delay it, you know, they'll delay that 20 minutes or an hour, whatever, you know, depending on where Mars is at the time. They'll delay the transmissions. They'll go through procedures. You know, they go out in the water. They put on what looks like spacesuits and all. So they're underwater. And they live and work together. And a lot of similar things go on in NEMO that we go on in a regular space mission. So I thought I'd bring him up because I remember you asking about him. Whatever happened to Steve Squires? Last time I saw him, he was on TV and looked a few years old. But in 2004, when Spirit and Opportunity landed, and he was all over the news. Back to you, Dick. WS2N, Space Report.
Yeah, that Project NEMO, because each foot of water that you go down into, you see approximately 0.4 pounds per square inch of pressure increase. You go down 60 feet and you get 25 pounds per square inch of total increase. So that's 25 pounds compared to the 14.7 that we normally live under. That's a ratio of not quite 2 to 1, 1 3/4 total air pressure. As such, I suspect the body acts differently. Do they breathe special gases like a helium barren gas like they do when they go very deep so as not to get bends? When you dwell for long periods of time, even at a depth that's not so deep, like 60 feet, I suspect there is, with normal air, nitrogen absorption into the joints that could give you problems. So I'm guessing they might need a special air mixture. What do you think, Paul? WS2N, K2RIW?
they do. I've seen quite a few different shows about Nemo. I'm trying to remember if they, that's part of the procedure, if they're running helium or not. But, you know, I mean, they are under constant pressure. You know, they, like, if you look at the floor, you can see the water. So, you know, the air pressure inside is pushing the water so the water can't come in. So to get out, all they have to do is jump through the hole, and they're off to the underworld. They have a couple of modules attached together. If you ever see pictures, you look on the internet, I mean, they all look like they're all covered with green, you know, bacteria, whatever it is, algae. They look like they've been down there forever, and they have been. I mean, I think this is their 16th mission of doing this type of thing. But it's an interesting project. A lot of people have done it, and they do learn a lot from that. So, through the internet, you see him, he's swimming around, he's got this big bubble on him, on his head, you know, floating around down there. You know, like a big suit on. So he's really involved. Comes out of Cornell. Really took over Carl Sagan's job when Carl Sagan got involved. Yeah, he, you know, Sagan was the main astronomer professor at Cornell upstate New York. And this guy really took his place. An interesting, you know, how things go from one, you know, from one guy to another. So there you go. That's the story about Steve Squires. Still probably active, I guess, with the, you know, with the rovers to some extent.
Repeater, time out.
One last question, Paul. In any of the documentaries you've seen on Project Nemo, is it possible you've heard the voice of any of the people speaking while they're 60 feet underwater? Does their voice sound extra deep, which would happen if they're breathing ordinary air, or does it sound high in pitch if they were breathing helium? Did their voice sound normal if any of the documentary allowed you to hear their voice under that environment? Back to you, Paul.
A comment, Dick. I think it's normal, by the way. Go ahead, John.
Dick, I believe you're right, because along with the bends, there's another issue with nitrogen, which is rupture of the deep, nitrogen sarcosis, so they would probably be dealing with some sort of helium aspect. Whether it be enough to affect their voice, I don't know, but I'm sure if they're down there for long duration, they'd have to worry about that.
Yeah, if I understand it correctly, John, you're fairly sure that for any duration in 2 weeks is, to me, a significant duration to live under... let's see now, almost two atmospheres, or is it even more than two atmospheres, but a lot of pressure. What did I calculate before? I've forgotten. 26 pounds per square inch of increase, something like that?
I always wanted a half a pound for a foot, you know, ballpark figure, Dick.
Yeah, roughly half a pound per foot, and 60 feet down is 30 extra pounds. So 30 extra pounds on top of the 15. So it's a total of, it sounds like it's getting close to triple atmospheric pressure. You put a human being for 2 solid weeks under triple atmospheric pressure, I am guessing he better be breathing a special air mixture, not ordinary air. I think he's going to get in trouble. We'll soon confirm whether or not that's true. Okay. Last week we had a bit of a discussion on Judy Wood material. And I suddenly realized what was going on there, Wes. In the case of your material that you presented to us last week, there was the thermal test, there was the valid material, there was the thermal stress, there was the material under test, there was the Judy Wood material. If I add up all of the individual times of those videos, 14 minutes, 9 minutes, 14 minutes, the Judy Wood material was an hour and 16 minutes. If you just read her material directly, if you start looking at her compact diagrams, you start expanding that, you go to her website, you find out her credentials, to really pour through the Judy Wood material takes you close to 2 hours. So 2 hours plus the other materials, we're talking about an awful lot of time to study that which was going to be under discussion last week. Combined with the discussion on the air, we're talking about a significant number of hours. I now have a little more understanding why so few people were prepared to address that material. I did look at the Judy Wood material. She is a, let me drop. She's a talented lady, very well educated. She's got her civil engineering BS degree, her engineering and mechanics and applied physics MS degree, her PhD degree in material engineering and science in the years 81, 83, 92. She also was a Virginia State Poly, let's see now, and State University at Blacksburg, Virginia. So she's got a lot of history, written a whole lot of articles and whatever. So she's got lots of credentials. That's the good news. However, in that major video that you wanted us to review, she spent a lot of time talking about dustification. She was convinced that that was not a building collapse, it was dustification of a building. That's not a very well understood scientific word. She frequently used the word silly string when things were burning and coming out of the building and leaving a trail as they left the building. It was the silly string phenomena. So she spent a lot of time on dustification, silly string. She spent a lot of time being confused about all the broken windows, the center, the round holes in the windows. And I'm amazed that she didn't realize what I'm about to tell you. Let me drop. And that is, each World Trade Center building was roughly 1,380 feet high. Each building had a volume, outside volume, of 690 million cubic feet. The volume of the building is 690 billion cubic feet. At least half of that volume, if not more, was air. The building has a mass of 1 billion pounds. So a billion pounds of building, 690 billion cubic feet, 1,380 foot high. You go through the mathematics of that, and that is a, I forget how many joules, 935 billion joules of gravity energy is in that building. Each one of those buildings has an amount of potential energy just due to mass and altitude equal to 1% of the Hiroshima bomb. Each building is 1% of a Hiroshima bomb in sheer kinetic correction, potential energy being converted into kinetic energy. When you start off with that amount of energy, that amount of air pressure, that amount of weight, the puff of air coming out of there can break every window within a significant number of feet and fractions of a mile. It can blow over all kinds of things. It can pulverize all kinds of things. She also has a series of graphs which show how long it should have taken for the pancake collapse. And therefore, she wanted the seismic data to represent seismic data for that length of time. I strongly disagree with her. If I had a pancake, had a building that was pancaking from the top, and it didn't, but if I had a building that was pancaking...
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
I had a building that was pancaking stage by stage from the top floor down to the bottom floor. You would have very little seismic material. You have very little seismic effect until it finally hit the bottom. You have a little bit of acoustic coupling through the steel of the building of the upper floors being pancaked. Some acoustic coupling through the steel. The acoustic signature is going to be much too short. She also has a bunch of graphs of the amount of time it should have taken for the falling of the building, assuming that each pancaking stage issued a individual bowling ball, so to speak, that fell by simple gravity from that point. And she came up with, you know, curves that show the event taking out to 18 seconds. Well, it didn't collapse that way. So, as you can tell, I'm not an expert in this area. I'm not qualified to really say. She's got a lot of credentials. But some of her assumptions are very difficult for me to accept. It's a little bit... I know that you were somewhat frustrated last week by the fact that very few of us had reviewed that material and were able to discuss it, and I can sort of see why. It took a minimum of 2 hours of review to be able to figure out what she's trying to say and whether or not you agree or disagree with it and whether or not something mysterious going on. Was there any kind of intentional demolition as opposed to a real terrorist act as it appeared to be. By the way, let me drop one other thing. She then went and issued a lawsuit, a qui tam lawsuit, against each one of the contractors that were working for NIST, National Institute of Standards and Technology, that were doing the research as to the materials. She issued a lawsuit claiming that they were grossly negligent in what they were doing. Where's the actual wording of that? She was claiming that all of these subcontractors were grossly negligent and therefore coming to the wrong conclusion. That's a tough case, and I don't think that one's going to be easily won, although I think it's already been settled. These are some of my early opinions on the Judy Wood material. I'm not convinced that, as I said, I'm not an expert. I don't really know. Mechanical engineering is not my main field. But some of the physics that she's claiming about dustification, silly string, and broken windows, I think there's a lot of misunderstanding there. N2XJN, who brought us this material, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Thank you very much, N2XJN. Analysis of the window damaging mechanism. Joseph E. Edward Minor, Civil Engineering, Desideration, submitted to graduate faculty of Texas University, Doctor of Philosophy approved. Based on this paper, scientific paper, windows don't break circularly. The cracks, 97.75% of the windows breaks in the straight lines. In the windows that you have had that she was mentioning, you have a circular pattern of the breakage, and no window is broken. You have just holes. Let me drop. Okay, now. They were doing the investigation at different speeds, different velocity, and different thickness of the glass. The study was also based on the previous set of studies by different scientists starting from 1972. They were also investigating a 22 stories building and higher. John Hancock building in Boston and plenty of others. So they were doing really a very good research in it. By that, the circular pattern of the windows broken with no other part of that particular piece of glass broken is somehow unexplained and somehow very much suspicious. As far as Dr. Judy Wood, she was also mentioning, if I remember correctly, building number 7. When you look at the photograph picture, satellite picture, you see two. The building is from the other side of the street and is partially covered by the remaining of the building on the block of the World Trade Center that was building 5. And you see only the footprint of it. So the building basically doesn't exist. The debris is there, but not much of it. But at the same time, you see two buildings on the left-hand side and the right-hand side of that particular building, and they have a sharp edges. Nothing happened to those buildings. So that's another thing that is unexplained. I'm not trying to create conspiracy theory in here. I don't care about if they are right or wrong. All I need is just to analyze the scientific data. At the same time, she was mentioning also the seismic data, and she was analyzing the time frames from hundreds of materials, video materials, and she was trying to find the average speed of collapse. And based on her words, the building collapsed approximately 2 seconds faster than it would be free fall. Nothing is faster than free fall. So we have another factor. Now, as far as justification, she was analyzing the video data, and she was pointing at the pattern of collapse. She stated that it was first time in the history of the Earth that a building collapsed such very much unusual way. And also, she was giving a number of reference to the number of parts that turn into the dust in front of your eyes. Whether it turned to the dust or did not is up to somebody's perception. But it's pretty much convincing that when I see the vertical columns, which were four vertical columns, and then I look at the historic data of how the World Trade Center was built, that those columns could not separate. But it looks like they do. Also, when you look at the debris, once it's separated from the main structure, should fall by the laws of physics. You look at those debris, and then you see that this debris in front of your eyes turn into the dust. Another factor that is somehow noticeable is that you do not have a clear picture on the second plane hitting the tower, and all of the video, most of the video that I have seen did have an alteration or somehow of an unknown reason why it stopped at the very moment. So I approached one of the guys who was doing the video that was showing almost the faces of the people who were in the windows or falling down. And I asked him, could you please give me those two frames that are being cut off? Because he was showing his video continuously from the time at the beginning of to the heat of the plane. His answer was, I was changing the battery at this time. Well, he couldn't change the battery in 3 seconds. And to XGN.
With such a large number of windows that were all broken with sort of a roundish hole in the center of the glass, is my belief that you've got a possible explanation by way of high-pressure, dense material. The pressure wave that occurred on the building in Oklahoma City when Timothy McVeigh set off that bomb, it did break windows in a somewhat similar manner, although that was just ordinary air. The debris that was coming off that building was very high-density, pulverized concrete, asbestos powder, all kinds of jazz in that high-pressure puff of air. People are of the opinion that the amount of debris at ground zero at the end of the event was too little. Well, that debris was spread over square miles. It was that huge cloud at the time of collapse had spread all over the place. And quite a few people died from trying to breathe that particular material. Also, when you're looking at a photograph of the dustification of a building as it's collapsing, an awful lot of what looks like dust to you, in some cases because the photograph is taken from a long distance away, really are chunks of steel that were in the perimeter of the building. And they look like little bitty matchsticks or something a lot smaller because of the distance and the number and the speed at which this is all taking place. It is my guess, Wes, if somebody did a analysis, a summation, what am I looking for? An accounting. If someone did an accounting for all of the steel that was captured and either reused or sold, I suspect that the number of pounds of steel that was recovered at the end of that event after all of the cleanup took place and the number of pounds of steel that were originally in the building, I think those number of pounds would be almost the same. There are people thinking that the steel got vaporized and scattered somewhere else. I think 90-some-odd percent of the steel could be accounted for. And those windows with the round holes, I think high density, high pressure shock wave in air can do that to windows. I'll admit that very rarely in history has there been such a high density, such a large amount of air under so much pressure being exerted on so many square meters of buildings. There's very rarely ever been an event like that. So it's kind of hard to go back in history and say I've ever seen anything like that. Oklahoma City comes close. I mean, if we're going to think that there's some other explanation, that somebody did something funny to every one of those thousands of buildings, every one of those thousands of windows, I think that would be a very difficult case to support. Now back to you, Wes. N2XJN, K2LIW.
Yeah, I have a part three, the missile. The part three actually is examination of the missile undertaking of the major phase. I'm trying to reach research hypothesis proven. But I'm going to shortly say what is it about. They were actually using trying to simulate any kind of environment, trying to find out how the glass of different kind reacts of it. The result, 100% of the windows broke into the in lines of different shapes, and they were actually explaining that those shapes were actually due to the mechanical impact through the glass and the inner pressure through the process of production of those. None of them appears to be cylindrical. Also, the point of Oklahoma, I didn't see, although I was going through that material, one single window that was broken this way. That means you had a hole, but the window was actually intact. Let me jump. Now, talking about a building that disappears, but at the same time two buildings on the sides are not even touched, how would you explain that? And the second question is, how would you explain cars without the engines, but at the same time being on tires, where the part of that car is painted and the other one is rusted after a few hours, and cars are at FDR. N2XGN.
Don't know if anybody can explain that. And yeah, those are tough ones. An unusual event, without a doubt. And we'll be discussing it for a long time to come. And many of these things are not going to be settled. There is no easy way of settling them. It's such a unique event. Such a large amount of mass, such a large amount of volume, such a large amount of energy, such a small amount of time. An unusual construction of building. That World Trade Center is different than the construction of any other building that has ever been made. And some of the other World Trade Centers also are somewhat unique in their construction. And the way that shock wave can spread throughout that plaza as those buildings collapse, and the way it can channel in between the two buildings that were left standing and find that channel to building number 7. And because of the particular construction of building number 7, lots of burning materials were deposited on it, on its roof, and throughout its, probably throughout its multiple floors. Lots of windows were broken by that pressure wave in that particular building. And that pressure wave, let me drop. When you've got a whole lot of windows on one side of a building, and a massive pressure wave comes and breaks those windows, it's a little bit similar to what happened in the Oklahoma City situation.
So why then the buildings on the side were not touched by that very big pressure? If you look at the map, and you look at the picture, then you see that the building that was right parallel to the World Trade Center building is standing. Nothing happened to it. But building number 7, if I remember correctly, is down. N2XGN.
Did building number 7 have a different method of construction as compared to the two that were standing? Go ahead, John.
Dick, that's like trying to explain a tornado that passes down, rips houses apart, but one adjacent to it doesn't get touched. Yeah, a vortex can do strange things.
Oh yeah, vortex can do strange things. So we had a very strange vortex just at building number 7, and also because of that very strange vortex, few cars happen to not have engines. And then we have instant rustification, and at the same time we have a ton of papers that were not burned, and we have a green trees. Here's the point. I spoke to John. Let me jump. You see the green on one of the photographs. You see the green tree with the leaves untouched completely by that very strange vortex. There is a car that is touching that tree, and it does have instant rustification. It does have a tires. Part of it, which is a pure iron, is simply completely damaged, but the other part has a paint on it and tires are on it. Next to it, there is a fire truck, and the fire truck is completely damaged, and you see also the sharp lines of the razor lines between the paint. But for some reason, this tree, and I analyzed about 100 trees, I know maybe that those are the same trees. Nothing happened to the trees. And no signs of the burnt paper. And to XGN. Next to this car, of course.
Without a doubt, Wes, there are things here that happened that are very difficult to explain. Where do you recommend we go from here?
Well, I think we have quite a few interesting factors to discuss. I believe that you react, and John, you react based on your belief. You don't react based on the scientific facts. Dr. Judy Wood was giving a fact. The facts were not answered with the facts. Were answered with the belief. That's my impression from that discussion. I have a number of emails that I have sent to you, and I would like to talk about that. And to exchange.
You're talking about this week's weather materials, and I think now we're going to go to the magneting, the vibrating magnets. Is that true, Wes? Go ahead.
Yes. The first is a vibrating magnet. It's a very short video. You have a toroidal ferrite, and you have a two magnet stick to the sides of it. On the right hand side you have a coil. The coil is sending the electromagnetic wave starting from 0 to, I believe, 10 hertz. At a certain point, the first vertical magnet starts to vibrate. The other one that is along the line from the other side of the horizontal ferrite that is sitting on it, it's not vibrating. And at a certain point, it starts to vibrate. Question, why is that happening? And what is the mechanism of it? And maybe you will be able to explain to the audience how the structure looks like. And to Israel.
Yeah, we can all get a copy of these particular emails. Each one of these videos now are 2, 3, 4 minutes long. So they are viewable within the period that we're having this discussion. So if you go to huntfamily.com, bernie@huntfamily.com, you'll be able to get a copy of these. Now, the one with the vertical magnets, you've got a very large flat washer laying on the table. You've got a small toroidal magnet. In other words, you've got a neodymium magnet that looks like a washer. It's sitting up vertical. The first magnet is on the let's call it the right hand side, the second magnet's on the left hand side of the large washer sitting on the table. The large washer on the table, let me make some approximations here. Let's assume the large washer on the table has a 6 inch outer diameter and a hole in the center that's a 2-inch diameter. So therefore, there is a roughly a 2-inch width of the washer on the left side and the right side of the hole of what you're seeing when you look at this at an isometric view. In the middle of the large washer laying on the table, say in the middle, on the what's the word I can look for now? If I consider this a orbit, now that wouldn't do it. Let me go for the 6 inches and the 2 inches again. 6 and 2, 4, yes. So the width of the large washer on the table, the width between the center hole and the outer edge, is approximately 2 inches. And so in the middle of that 2-inch width of washer, you have a vertical perpendicular ring magnet. It looks like a small washer. You got one on the right-hand side and one on the left-hand side of that large washer.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Looks sort of like Mickey Mouse ears.
That's a very good way of putting it, John. So the whole thing looks like a pair of Mickey Mouse ears sitting on top of a head, so to speak, but the head in this case is a very large flat washer on the table. Now, each of those individual washer-shaped magnets, the washer on the table is not a magnet in itself, but each of the vertical washer-shaped magnets, the Mickey Mouse ears, has a automatic restoring force. In other words, if you displace it toward the center of the large washer and let go of it, it'll spring back to where it started from. If you displace it toward the outer perimeter of the large washer, it'll spring back again. So it is a kind of a pendulum. It wants to be in the center of the large flange of the washer. There's one on the right side, and there's a similar Mickey Mouse ear slash magnet on the left-hand side. So they have an automatic pendulum-like function. They want to be in the center, and if you push them to the left or the right of where they want to be, they tend to spring back when you let go of them. Now when you excite this thing with an external coil, and you're putting a electromagnetic wave, when you're putting a voltage into that coil, you're creating a cyclic magnetic field. Let me drop. That cyclic magnetic field is creating a pushing force that tends to push that vertical ring magnet, the right-hand rabbit ear, or right-hand Mickey Mouse ear, tends to push it toward the center of the large washer or pull it away from the center. And when you hit the right resonant frequency, 7.8 hertz, you get the maximum deflection. You're just proving resonance, in my opinion. Very similar to the way you push a child on a swing. Push the child at the right period of time, the child on the swing builds up a very large amplification. And so each of these Mickey Mouse ears are each very close to 7.8 hertz. The coupling between the right-hand electromagnet that's making the cyclic magnetic wave, it is closest to the right-hand Mickey Mouse ear. It is further from the left-hand Mickey Mouse ear. And when you hit exact resonance of about 7.8 hertz, not only do you get maximum deflection of the right-hand Mickey Mouse ear, it tends to move left and right from your field of view, eventually it also couples to the left-hand one, which is much more loosely coupled, but is also displays resonance. So whenever you've got two simultaneously resonant systems with a coupling coefficient between them, as you slowly change the exciting frequency, you will see this phenomena of positive and negative beating waves, so to speak. And so I've seen something similar to this where you have a complex pendulum. You've got one horizontal string between two supports, and in two different locations you hang two pendulums from that swing. Each individual pendulum has a certain length, a certain resonant frequency, and even though you're only moving one of the pendulums, it's got a mechanism by which it couples to the other one. So compound coupled resonating things will behave in this manner. Although it's a nice, exciting-looking video to view, my first impression is that there's not any magic there once you understand where the restoring force is coming from, once you understand where the resonance is coming from. Let me first ask John what his impression is when he saw that movie of the Mickey Mouse ears. KC2WGB, K2RIW. Go ahead, John.
Yes, when it hits resonance, it works exactly as you're saying. That's my belief. And if the magnets were different strength or different physical size, it would be a different resonant frequency. There's no magic in 7.8. It just happens to work with that system. But basically, I think it's exactly the way you described it, Dick. Nothing complicated.
Well, I have some much different opinion than you, gentlemen.
Of course.
I love when John says that. Dick, what is Schumann effect?
Let's say I don't know what the Schumann effect is because you're about to explain it to me.
John?
Oh, I'm ignorant also. I don't know.
The Schumann resonances are a set of spectrum peaks in extremely low frequency portion of the Earth magnetic field spectrum. And the Schumann resonance is the global electromagnetic set of resonances excited by lightning discharges in the cavity formed by the Earth's surface in ionosphere. Now, this global electromagnetic resonance phenomenon I'm reading right now is named after physicist Winfried Otto Schumann, who predicted it mathematically in 1952. Schumann resonance occurs because the space between the surface of the Earth and the conductive ionosphere acts as a closed waveguide. The limited dimension of the Earth caused the waveguide to act as a resonance cavity for the electromagnetic waves in the EF band. The cavity is naturally excited by electric current in lightning, but of course could be excited by other currents or electromagnetic waves. Schumann resonance is a principal background to the electromagnetic spectrum, beginning at 3 Hz and extend to 60 Hz, and appear as distinct peaks at extremely low frequencies, ELF, around 7.86 of Hz, fundamental. So, in normal mode, description of Schumann's resonances, the fundamental mode is the standing wave in the Earth ionosphere cavity with the wavelength equal to circumference of the Earth. The lowest frequency and the highest intensity mode of the Schumann resonance occurs at the frequency of approximately 7.86 Hz. But this frequency can vary slightly from variety of factors such as solar perturbation, ionosphere, comprising whatsoever. So, since we know that the highest resonance modes are approximately 6.5 Hz and up, then we could say that if we can excite those two magnets by electromagnetic wave, similar to the way that is explained in here, I say that we have a Schumann effect in here. And to it.
What I'm saying is that if I added some extra weight to either of those Mickey Mouse ears so that their resonant frequency was lower and it was now operating at 5 Hz instead of 7.8 Hz, would it still be the Schumann effect? Over to you.
I don't know. I was just looking at the explanation of it, and then I was looking at the Wikipedia, which says about Tesla research ways to transmit power energy wirelessly over long distances. They also try to implement a Schumann effect in here. And in Wikipedia, you have a mathematical calculation based on this experiment. Tesla discovered that the resonance frequency of the Earth is approximately 8 Hz. In 1950, researchers confirmed that the resonance frequency of the Earth ionosphere spheric cavity was in this range. So, then there is a speculation about electromagnetic wave excitation or whatsoever. Now, what is electromagnetic wave? It's the magnetic and electric field. And to Exian.
The fact that his two Mickey Mouse ears resonated at 7.8 Hz, and maybe that's the center of the frequency of the Schumann effect, could be a coincidence. Is he demonstrating the Schumann effect there? One way to find out would be to increase the mass of a rabbit ear without changing its magnetic field strength. And you and I could easily do that. I can add some extra massive material layer, like maybe copper. I think it would resonate at a lower frequency, and therefore, and it might act the exact same way. If I weighted down the two rabbit ears the exact same way, and if both of them came down in lower frequency, but coupled in a very similar way, and now they resonated at 5 hertz, I don't think it would be demonstrating that you're seeing a Schumann effect in that video. I'm not convinced that we're seeing a Schumann effect in that video, Wes. I'm challenging that. I can't be sure, but that's my feeling on the subject. Over to you, Wes, K2RIW.
In 1954, Mr. Koenig, German, attempted to measure the resonance frequencies. And when I went through his material, he was also using the electromagnetic waves to excite the magnets. And he came to the conclusion of confirmation of the Schumann effect frequency, fundamental frequency. There was another individual, I don't remember his name also, who was working with it. So, yes, we might be convinced, we might not be convinced, but definitely it's worth the effort just to mention that Schumann effect exists, and eventually that it reacts as a standing wave, and it has a cavity with a wavelength equal to circumference of the Earth. At least something for us to think about it. Then I have another video. And let's go to part number two. Part number two, we have a magnetic field on aluminium. So basically what is going on in here is a gentleman has three pieces of the magnet, and he's playing with it. One magnet he put this out, and then the magnet slides through the sheet of the aluminium. The aluminium is slightly by an angle, but when he reverses the polarity, the magnet pops out. Wow. But then he takes another magnet just to make sure that he didn't have any coincidence in it, and he finds out exactly the same. But then, because the second magnet wasn't that strong, I believe, he changed the angle of the sheet of aluminium to have a bigger slope. And eventually, when he was playing with it, he was able to have this magnet to keep somehow from both sides. But there was no comparison. Then he took a magnet that was kind of rectangular, and he slid that magnet on the piece of aluminium. And all of a sudden, with the north side, he find out that the magnet is curving to the right. And with the south side, the magnet is curving to the left. Questions. Why the magnet didn't hold from both sides? Through the law... I don't even want to assign that. Are we dealing with the Lorentz forces in here or with eddy currents in here? I mean, what is going on? And eventually, what is that curving coming from? Enter here.
You gave him a wrong description, Wes.
Yeah, I'm going to repeat the description for those who are listening. In the actual audio, in the actual video, they started off with a sheet of aluminum, which I'm going to say was all 1.5 feet wide and almost 3 feet high. And the sheet of aluminum was not quite perpendicular to the table. It was tilted all 5 or 10 degrees away from perpendicular. A neodymium iron, an NIB, neodymium iron boron, I guess it's magnet, a magnet approximately the diameter of a nickel, a U.S. currency nickel, was placed against the aluminum sheet. And when you place it against the aluminum sheet near the top and you let go of it, it slides down the aluminum, and with one particular polarity, north out or south out, I'm not sure which it was, it slides down the aluminum very conveniently. Flip the nickel-sized magnet upside down, opposite polarity, and put it against the same sheet of metal, and it doesn't slide smoothly. It jumps away from the sheet of metal. I've got a guess as to what's going on. Let me drop.
It did the experiment thing.
Did you get similar results, John, before I explain what I think is happening? Over to you, John.
Dick, I took the quarter-size neodymium magnet, similar to the one I sent to you, and I slid it down on an aluminum sheet. I've done this a while back, but I redid the experiment because I was interested that I didn't make a mistake. When I reversed my magnet, I didn't notice any difference. It still hugged the aluminum all the way down, and no matter how I changed the angle.
But I think there's a chance that he's not creating a hoax with that video. There's a chance that his particular magnet did that. And if so, it is my guess that depending on what brand of neodymium magnet you buy, depending on how it was magnetized, we're here assuming naively that no matter what brand of neodymium magnet you buy, that you're always getting a uniform magnetic field across the axis. In other words, if the magnetic field, if the neodymium magnet, which starts off unmagnetized, and is put into this huge electromagnet, and you put a god-awful pulse of voltage across that coil on that magnet, and therefore you give a permanent magnetization to your neodymium magnet. However, depending on whether or not the magnet that you're magnetizing fills up the gap completely or only is partially filling the gap. If you're partially filling the gap and the thing that you're magnetizing is off to one side on the gap, you then get a kind of divergence of magnetic field. You don't have a uniform magnetic field along the axis of the neodymium magnet. The neodymium magnet is really a very short cylinder. The cylinder has an axis down the short dimension. You'd like to believe you're getting uniform magnetic field along that axis. Depending on whether or not you stacked it against one of the poles of the magnetizing device, you can easily get a situation where you get a kind of divergence where the magnetic field lines are closer to the center on the north side and further from the center on the south side. And if you're getting that kind of divergence of magnetic field, and now you're wiping it across, let me drop. You're wiping it across the aluminum sheet, and you're generating these eddy currents in the aluminum sheet, very similar to what happens when you take a neodymium magnet and you drop it down a piece of copper tubing. It moves very slowly through the copper tubing because of the eddy currents that are induced into the copper tubing, very similar to the old-fashioned speedometer devices that used to be on our automobiles. You had a cup-shaped device. You had a rotating magnet that was being turned by a speedometer cable that connected to the drive shaft of your automobile, and depending on how fast the drive shaft was turning, it was turning that magnet inside of that cup. The cup was on a spring mechanism, which was kind of a Dawson valve movement, and it moved the needle across your instrument panel, and it told you you're going 50 miles an hour. So that was an eddy current moving magnetic field in a aluminum cup, and here we've got a magnet that's sliding across an aluminum plate. And so non-uniformity, I think you've got a higher quality of neodymium magnets, John. Yours have more axial uniformity. In other words, your magnet, when it was being magnetized, was in the center of the gap. Therefore, it has uniform field lines of magnetic field as opposed to slightly divergent ones. That's my guess as to what could be happening. What's your guess on that one, John? KC2WGB. K2RIW in the tech net.
Dick, I could see physically that might happen in magnetizing a magnet, but now the total fields would have to be identical in strength on both ends, would it not? Even though it's concentrated in one spot, possibly. Because I can't see it working any other way, that the magnet would be stronger at one end than the other.
I disagree. If I took my unmagnetized thing and I placed it across the left-hand tang of the gap, and I've got an air gap on the right-hand side, I can now have a highly concentrated magnetic field in the center of the left-hand side of the thing being magnetized, and a much more divergent field on the right-hand side. the magnetic lines of force are, let's say, entering the left-hand side of your neodymium magnet. I've got my neodymium magnet up vertical, and so along the axis on the left-hand side, I'm looking at magnetic lines entering that left-hand face, and they're entering primarily near the center, near the axis. However, as they go through the material, they are spreading out like a mushroom and exiting the right-hand side at a much greater divergence. They're being spread out. Therefore, if I use a Hall effect device and measure the specific magnetic field right at the axis on the left-hand side and right at the axis on the right-hand side, I would come up with two different numbers. The peak magnetic field at the axis on the right-hand side, because of that spread, would be a lower number. You see what I'm saying on that one, John? KC2WGB, K2RIW.
KC2WGB. Yes, I understand what you're saying. I did not know that was possible, that that could be done. But if it could be done, and if that's the way it works, then I could understand that happened exactly the way it happened in that video. Also, Wesley is describing improbably the sliding of the rectangular magnet. I believe it favored the south pole, not direction. If you watch that video, it didn't switch from south to north. It favored the south pole when it made its curve.
Please make it, when it flipped the polarity, it curved the other side, the opposite one. The guy didn't provide actually us with changing the pattern of the aluminum sheet at 90 degrees. So we do not know really how the aluminum sheet was oriented towards the south and north of the Earth. But we know that we have a significant factor of the curving line following the polarization. Dick?
Yeah, let's not leave the first subject yet. John, if I had a bar magnet in front of me, and I lay a piece of paper on top of it, and I sprinkle iron filings over it, it gives me a visualization of way the magnetic field lines form. From the right-hand side of the bar magnet, I would see the lines of magnetic field exiting that area and diverging away from the axis. They would be curving away so that each of the magnetic lines of force eventually curved around into a complete circle, coming out of the right-hand side, which I'll call north, and eventually they enter the left-hand side, which I'll call south. So as magnetic lines of force leave a high permeability material called magnet or iron, as they leave that material and enter air, they tend to spread out away from each other. So if my magnetizing device that's magnetizing my neodymium magnet happens to have, let me pick a number now, it's got a rod coming out of its electromagnet that is, let me pick a number, 1 inch in diameter. And the neodymium magnet I'm about to magnetize is 1.5 inches in diameter. Before I put my device to be magnetized in there, I just turn on the magnetic field, and by some means I map it out. I would see the magnetic lines of force exiting the left-hand rod, spreading out into air and diverging. I now place my 1.5 inch diameter magnet that I wish to magnetize against that left-hand rod that is 1 inch in diameter in my example. Obviously, I'm going to get a strong concentration of magnetic field near the center axis on the left-hand side. I'm going to get a strong magnetic field near the axis, near the center, on the left-hand side of my neodymium magnet that I'm magnetizing. As the magnetic lines of force flow through that thing that I'm magnetizing, and as they exit the right-hand side and they're entering the air, they're diverging. They're moving away from the center axis. And that's the method by which I'm going to be magnetizing that particular magnet, because I've got an air gap on the right-hand side. I've got a diverging magnetic field inside of the thing that they're going to ship to me. It's going to be more concentrated on the left near the center, near the axis, and less concentrated near the center axis on the right-hand side. And by way of a Hall Effect small magnetic sensing device, I could confirm that. So if you buy brand X neodymium magnets,